Welcome to another episode of Audio Dust Jacket. I'm your host, Kevin Finn. We have some great authors for you today. First up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Rick Paulson. Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks, Kevin. How about yourself?
Ah, we're doing good. So we're here to talk about making a superstar company today. So give us a little of your backstory.
Well, I started in radio in high school in 1973. I've been in and out of the industry ever since. I've also done things as far as wholesale to retail sales with a computer accessory company that was a global operation. Worked some couple of years at Walt Disney in Florida. So I've done a variety of things and gathered a lot of information over the years, and I put it all into this new book.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, it was written primarily for people either getting ready to start a business or have recently started a business within the last 3 years. But that doesn't mean that somebody that has a 15- or 20-year-old company can't get benefit from the book. I share a lot of information, starting out basically with colors for the company. Most people think that they have to come up with a lot of different things, but you have to figure out what your colors are going to be and how that's going to impact your expected market. So I give you some ideas in that as far as a couple of basic colors, and then I suggest that you research color psychology on the internet so that you can make sure that you pick the proper colors for your target market.
So
about the colors,
is it too many colors that people normally pick? What's the common mistake that someone makes when they're picking out colors for their company? Because I don't think many people think that's a really big deal.
Well, let's look at it this way. If you go into a lot of restaurants or places that serve alcohol, you'll find the color red either on their walls, on their table, or in their menus. Red makes you thirsty.
Just like on the cover of your book.
Right. So it's one of those things where if you're going after a female market, are you going to use burgundy? Probably not. If you're going to go after a male market, are you going to use a very light shade of blue? Probably not. So you just need to kind of figure out what color scheme is going to best suit you and what the psychology of that color is going to present to your customers.
Wow, I would never think of any of that or know any of that. So that's awesome.
And then I go into things like basic marketing materials, letterheads, business cards, brochures, and come up with some different off-the-cuff kind of ideas for you to think about away from the standard market stuff that's out there now.
What would be the biggest mistake that people make when they do start trying to market their own small business?
The biggest mistake that everybody I've ever talked to has made is cutting marketing and advertising out of their budget. Less customers is not going to help you be successful. So if you have to make cuts, you need to make cuts either in employees or product line.
Well, if I'm marketing, why can't I just market myself? Do I have to bring someone in to market for me, or how can I do that? Because small companies really they have overhead and they have all these other expenses. How can they have a marketing budget?
Well, that's something that you have to plan for. When you're putting together your overall monthly budget, and I cover budgets in the book, you need to figure out. You've got this many number of employees. You've got this amount of price for the space and the utilities. How am I going to cover that budget? How many sales am I going to have to make at what dollar line am I going to have to make to cover that budget? And then based on that, that's how you're going to base your marketing and advertising scheme.
What is the best place for me to market my company?
I don't know if there is a best. It depends on what you're trying to market. If you're doing something that can be sold both over-the-counter and online, then you want to split the difference and do some online marketing and some traditional marketing, print, radio, TV, cable. I can't really say that there's a best because every business and every market is different. There's nothing that's traditional anymore. Back when I started in advertising in 1980, there was basically newspaper, magazine, radio, and TV. That was it. There was a little bit of direct mail going on, but those were the four primary marketing tools that people had. And it's just exploded over the years to a variety of different things. and you've got to figure out which is best for you. And that's why I give you examples in the book of all the different traditional and internet marketing schemes, so that you can make some educated decisions and not use the, quote, try this method, unquote.
So it doesn't matter what kind of company I have. If I get your book, I'm going to know how to market my company.
You're going to have a very good idea on how to market it. I don't tell you you have to do this or you have to do that. I present ideas. And then hopefully you're enough educated in your industry so that you can make the best marketing ideas from the suggestions I present.
Yeah, I can imagine. If you're not educated in your industry, you have a bigger problem than marketing.
Exactly. I mean, you can be the world's greatest shoe salesman, but if you don't know how to get the people into the store or on the line to buy the product, you're not going to be successful. And that's why I wrote the book, was to help people get that jump start to be successful.
So how's the book laid out? I haven't got a chance to read it yet, but it looks really interesting. How's it laid out? Is it an easy read? Can I read it in a short amount of time? Or how'd you write the book?
Well, the overall book is about 100 pages. It's not real long. Anybody that has a good reading pace can probably cover it in an hour, hour and a half. So what I suggest is that you read the entire book first and then go back to the beginning and take it one or two chapters at a time and cover all the areas that are in there so that you're not skipping steps and missing places. And then after you've done all your research and all your information gathering, then you can make proper marketing decisions because you've educated yourself and you've learned how to do it. But like I said, every market's different, so I can't say you got to do this or got to do that because it may not apply in your market or for your business model or for a variety of other reasons.
So after I read this book, could I carry it around as sort of a guide if I ever have a question or just keep it around as a reference material?
Absolutely. It would be something that you should go back to, I would say, in the first 3 years, maybe once every 6 months, just to review what you've done and what you can do or what you're thinking about doing and see how that applies to your business model.
So what primarily led you to write this book? Was it you saw a problem and you said, I have the solution, I have all the answers? Well, what led you to write it?
Well, it's kind of funny. I actually wrote this book about four or five times over the years. I never found a publisher to do anything with. And I stumbled across the publisher in another business venture that I was in. And we got together and talked about it, and I wrote the book and sent it out to her, and it got published. And I think the timing is excellent for it with the changes in the economy. A lot of people are coming out of corporate America and starting their own thing, whether it's online or storefront or service company or whatever it may be. And I cover all those different ideas in the book as well.
What was the hardest part about writing this book for you?
Well, to be honest, I wrote the entire book in 11 days. I just took time off and sat down and wrote the book. When you're doing something that you've done pretty much your whole life, it's not hard to reproduce your thoughts and processes. I just wanted to make sure I laid it out in a step-by-step format so that anybody that's new to growing a business or starting a business can do things step-by-step.
How are you yourself marketing this book right now?
Well, it's on Amazon, it's on Sony, it's on Kobo, and it's on Smashwords. Right now it's available as an e-book. It will be published as a paperback sometime later this spring.
Could you just walk us through maybe your favorite chapter in the book or the most important part of it, or just your favorite part?
Well, I think the two biggest chapters are the broadcasting facilities, radio and cable TV. You know, my start was in radio, so, you know, I'm more knowledgeable in that area than I am anywhere else, but I spent time in an advertising agency, so I covered all the rest of the things that are in the book. And I lay out in every area some ideas on what to do as far as how to schedule your time in radio, how to schedule your time in TV. I give you some ideas on how to present the location of the business in a much more effective way for broadcasting media. There's a lot of different things in there. And like I said, if you read the whole thing over once and then go through step by step, you won't miss anything.
Well, that's great. What do you want your readers to really take away from this book?
I want them to grow and be successful. I mean, there's a lot of people that start new businesses and in the first 2 to 4 years die because of one reason or another. Well, hopefully from here on out, marketing won't be the problem.
Do you have any interesting marketing stories you have from your experience that you've put into this book?
Not direct experiences. I just took all the things that I've learned to make the suggestions that are in the book. I don't relate it to any particular companies. What I can share with you, a long time ago, my very first radio advertising sales job, I worked with a furniture company. It was a very prestigious furniture company. They had a lot of upscale, very expensive pieces of furniture. My first reaction when I talked to the owner was, I don't do advertising. I don't do sales. I don't need to. Well, over 18 months, I kept going back, and eventually he says, you know, Rick, I got to run a sale. We ran a weekly schedule for the sale, and he was on ever since on an annual contract. So people need to be educated as far as what different advertising areas they can use and how they work, and that's what the book does, is it educates you so that you have an understanding and you're not doing guesswork on your planning.
So this book helps people realize they have a problem, because most people, small companies, probably don't understand that by not marketing, they're really hindering their growth.
Exactly. And, you know, and like I said, you can be an expert in selling shoes, or you can be the best air conditioning repair person starting a business, or you can be the best wholesale company. Regardless of what it is, you've got to market the business, and if you don't know how to do it, you're not going to grab an audience to do it with.
Ah, that's a really good point. Did you come away with anything writing this book, learn anything about yourself?
Well, I'm not a reader, and I say so in the book. I'm much more of an audiovisual person.
Same here.
One of the things I point out is that most websites don't have marketing videos on their homepage to market the company. You know, you put together a 100-page website, I'm going to read one or two pages, maybe. But if you have a 30- or 60-second video on the homepage of the website, you can tell me the whole story, and I'd be much more interested in doing business with you.
I completely agree. So I'm going to take it. Are you going to write any more books after this, or was this the one and done? This is the book you got out there?
Well, no. I never closed doors. This book has only been out for about 6 or 7 weeks, so it's real new to the market. I also have a Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and you go to the search bar, put in marketing a superstar company, you'll go to my Facebook page. I would appreciate that you liked it. And all of the links for all the places that you can buy the book are listed there.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We loved having you. If you could just give all your contact information, website, everything where people can find this book, because I think it'd help out a lot of companies.
Okay, I don't have a website yet. Like I said, I do have a Facebook page. Just go to the search bar, put marketing, making a superstar company into the search bar. You'll go to my page. Listed on my page is my email address, which is bigrickbook@yahoo.com. Those are the two primary ways to get a hold of me for now. Like I said, the book's very new, and I'm looking for it to grow quickly.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. We really loved hearing about it, and I know all our listeners did too. Thanks for coming on. Maybe we can have you back. Maybe if you write another book, that'd be great.
That would be awesome. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for having me.
Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Ann Sweezy Coolyou. Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Good. I didn't butcher your name, did I?
No, you got it just right. I don't know how you did it, but you did.
So we're here today to talk about, I think you have two current books and one book in the works. So The Thing with Feathers, Body, and I think Grog Wars is your working title?
Yeah. The middle one is Bodie. That's from Bodie, California.
Okay.
California State Park.
Well, I was bound to mess up sometimes, so I got your name, but I messed up the title of the book. So give us just a little backstory as yourself as a writer.
About me?
Yes.
Gosh, you know, I don't really have a backstory as a writer. I ended up in a bad car accident about 20 years ago, and I had nothing else that I could do from bed. I didn't want to be a telemarketer, so
who does?
I started writing. writing that book I always wanted to write, and the next thing I knew, I was on my second novel, and I'd never even written a short story before then, so I didn't have any education in creative writing. I had no background whatsoever, work experience-wise. I just decided to go for it. There was a story I wanted to tell, and it worked out pretty well.
That is amazing, yes. What was the hardest part about starting to write a book? Because to me, writing a book is terrifying.
Well, to most people, trying to write a book is terrifying. It's that awful blank page or blank screen, you know, that you're looking at. That's probably the hardest part. I tell people who I've mentored and coached that just put anything on there, anything. Just, I don't feel like writing today, or I don't know what to type, you know, and just something will get you started. And, you know, if all else fails, go out and have a glass of champagne and people watch, and it'll give you ideas.
So can anyone be a creative writer, or is it a special talent you have to be born with?
Well, I think creative writing has a lot of different avenues, and some of those avenues are not so much a gift, a talent, as a craft. I think screenwriting is a very creative activity and could be pretty prosperous, is more of a craft. It's more of a putting together of an art project than it is, I think, creative writing like a novel is. So, you know, I tell people if one style fits you better than another, go with what you know. You know, go with what you're good at.
Well, let's talk about some of your books. Let's talk about The Thing with Feathers. What is it about?
The Thing with Feathers is, well, it's a story about a young girl on the Oregon coast in 1927, which this was a pretty sparse and isolated place. Most of America considered the Northwest a mysterious unknown at that time. And this poor girl is 16 years old, and she's pregnant. And wouldn't you know, her father is the town's fire and brimstone Baptist preacher.
Oh, no.
But what the town doesn't know, what his own daughter doesn't even know, is he's not a real preacher at all. He just showed up in town one day and said he was, and the congregation needed a preacher, so they voted him in. Anyway, as it turns out, it's this Baptist preacher, the phony preacher, who is the rapist. And she gets some help from some fairly unlikely sources, and she ends up kind of in a Greek tragedy style a story. She's broken. She needs to fix herself before she can become the hero, and she does. It's a, you know, it's a dark topic.
Sounds like an empowering book, though.
Well, for women, I think it is. I mean, this girl had very little chance at survival, and she did it herself. You know, she fixed herself. She saved the day. She it's very uplifting, I think, in that it is such a dark story, and yet she shines through it with hope. I mean, that's what keeps her going. That's what keeps her alive in some places in the book. So, yeah, I would have to say that The Thing with Feathers is hope, just like the Emily Dickinson poem. That is the theme that I tried to get through all through the book. Lots of small Christian themes that I hope people pick up on. but overall, the title says it all. It's about hope.
Well, that's amazing. Did you grow at all from writing this book, or did you learn anything about yourself just going through this process? I know writing a book is a really personal experience.
It's almost like your child. and yes, I learned quite a lot. I learned a lot about my home state, where I call home. I learned a lot about the Christian faith and the different factions and practices of those factions. I had no idea that the Baptist, you know, that was a pretty common practice, I guess, in rural areas where, you know, people from seminaries just didn't get to, you know. So they had to have somebody lead them. There was usually an elder in the church or somebody like that that they just voted in. I didn't know about that either. And I learned a lot about myself. I share a lot of feelings with my main characters. And I've never been a victim of child abuse, but I kind of called on other sadnesses in my childhood to try to, when I was writing in her persona, I would just try to put myself back in times of extreme sadness and write from that spot and hope that I got it right. So I did talk to an awful lot of people who were chronically depressed. I talked to people who have suffered from PTSD, most of them soldiers, but children of victims of child rape also suffer from PTSD. And that's covered in the book pretty extensively, I think. And I hope I got it right, because I really do want this book to be something that can help a child out there who's going through such an experience. And if you've got no one to talk to, the only place to turn to is literature. You need to find a hero that you can relate to, and hopefully that hero will help you find a way, you know, out of the darkness. And I hope it helps people, because I tried to keep it historically accurate and also as accurate as I could be of a girl who is suffering PTSD as a result of this abuse that she's been through.
Well, that's one point I do want to talk about, is how much research goes into a book like this, because you weren't around there. You don't know much about the time. It seems like you put in an extensive amount of research before you can write this book, which is a story.
You know, there is a lot of research. I pride myself on that. I actually love to do the research. And what I do is pour through really just piles of it. And it's not just books. I did a lot of interviews with people and took a lot of notes. And what I do is I use those notes and my research to write pages and pages and pages about the characters that I'm going to use in my book. And I do that before I ever get started. And a story formulates. And if I know my characters well enough and I know what's going to happen generally along an outline, I know exactly what my characters are going to do and say, because I know them so well. So, you know, my advice would be for people who think they might want to try writing a novel is to, you know, get those characters down. And your research goes into them. And not everything that you learn actually makes it into the book. But it's important, for the writer to know really extensively what was going on at that time in that place, you know, so you don't shortchange your reader.
Did you ever run across writing this book where you were in a certain situation, you're like, well, this is how it's going to go, and then you realized, well, my character wouldn't do that, and it ended up changing sort of the course of the book a little bit?
Actually, one of my main characters in The Thing with Feathers had a completely different ending for that particular character. And I talked with my editor about it. I thought I could maybe strengthen that character. I don't want to say who it is because it gives
Yeah, don't,
away,
don't.
But,
we want our listeners to buy the book. We want our listeners to buy the book.
But I talked with my editor, and he said he'd send four suggestions. He had four suggestions for ways that we might change this character to make their character arc, you know, stronger, tighter, maybe please the reader a little bit more. And I took his fourth suggestion and went with it and scared the living daylights out of him, because it required me to rewrite about a third of the book, and I only had 30 days to do it in.
And you did it. Wow.
And I did it. And it came out even better than we thought it would. I mean, it just really made the book.
Well, you have to think, you spend every day with these characters. They become sort of like family. You get to really know them. So rewriting one third of the book to correct one of your characters to do something that he would do seems like it would be something you would have to do, really.
It's true. They are like real people to me, and if something's not quite right, it's got to have to be changed. And if that's a third of the book, that's a third of the book. It worked out.
I love to hear that. So let's go on to your second book you wrote, Bodhi. Not Body, Bodhi.
For... Right. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I write historical fiction exclusively, but mm-hmm. not one book is anything like the other. So actually, Bodhi is based on a true story. It's based on my own. It's about two sisters. Should I tell you about it?
Yeah, go ahead. This is for our listeners, so just to give a brief overview of the book for them. We want all everyone that listens to this to hopefully buy your book. So.
Okay. Well, it's about two sisters who realize that they're having the very same dream over and over and over again, and they've been doing it for years, and neither one knew the other one was having this dream. And when they find that out, they think that's strange, so they go and decide to have themselves regressed. And they do a dream regression, and they find out that one of the sisters actually had a past life, and that was the woman in their dream, and they never really were able to see the end of the dream. It always ended before, you know, it always ended too soon. And they found out that the woman was murdered, and that's why the dream ended, and they could never see anything further. The other sister was having the same dream because she's psychic. And But as I said, years went by and neither sister knew this. And when they found out, they wanted to investigate. Well, this therapist tells them if they actually go down to Bodie, California, where this woman was murdered, you know, at least the psychic would get impressions and stuff, and maybe they'd learn more. And so they did. And they did learn more. And what they stumbled upon was a, you know, Bodie was an old gold mining town, and they stumbled on an old secret that might have been more responsible for the deaths than the bad weather, bad whiskey, bad men that history tells us. You know, Bodie was the worst town in American history. It averaged a murder a day, they say.
Wow.
And they blamed it on everything but what the sisters decided was causing all those deaths. So it's kind of a mystery. It's an action-adventure. There's an evil mining company that doesn't want these sisters' story to ever see the light of day, so...
It sounds creative and great. It sounds really interesting. I definitely want to get my hands on it and check it out.
It's based on a true story. I was never chased around Bodie State Park by a hitman, but you know, it was based on a true story.
I think you find that the best authors always put themselves into their books, so in their personal experiences, and I think that comes across, so...
Yes, you have to. I mean, your characters are you. You are your characters, so...
All right, well, before we wrap up, let's talk about your third book. It's in the process, called Grog Wars. I have to think that has something to do with alcohol, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know if many of your listeners are aware, but Portland, Oregon is Shanghai capital of the world.
I did not know that. I love Portland. It's beautiful, but I did not know it was Shanghai capital of the world.
I love Oregon, too. It's wonderful. It is mysterious and beautiful. You know, back in the heydays of around 1850 to 1852, when the first Germans brought their lager style of brewing to Portland. Before that, everybody was going to Milwaukee and Chicago. This German brought his lager beer to Portland, and it was a dangerous time for Portlanders. The Shanghais that went on at every seaport in the country, heavier on the West Coast, actually. San Francisco was also a big one. But Portland, Oregon's Shanghais, 10 times the number of all of the other seaports combined. So pretty much any guy or any two guys that were caught walking down the street after dark were fair game.
So Beer and Murder sounds like it's going to be a great book.
It spans three different continents, and it's a four-year trek for this German fellow, and he has to do the Oregon Trail and all of its dangers, and his wife ends up having to come over by vessel because he wasn't going to send her on the trail, and that was fraught with danger. Most of those vessels weren't even seaworthy, and most of those people ended up in the drink out on the, you know, going around the horn. So, it's going to be very exciting.
Well, that's great. All three of these books have just great, interesting historical topics that readers can learn about, and great stories, it sounds like.
Well, thank you.
If our listeners wanted to go out and get these books, how can they do it? Give us URLs, your website, where they can buy them.
Right. They can buy them on my website, my name, but that's just too hard for people to remember and spell. So Historical Horse Feathers.
Ooh, I like that.
.com, with dashes between the words, historical-horse-feathers, is my website. They can find it on Amazon. They can find it on my publisher's website, Tate Publishing. They can find it at Barnes & Noble, pretty much everywhere.
So, yeah. So just for our listeners, again, the three books are The Things with Feathers, Bodie, and Grog Wars. Well, and...
Yeah, coming soon.
Thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure. And hopefully we can have you on maybe after you finish Grog Wars to come talk about that.
I would love that, Kevin. Thank you so much.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. You have a great day.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Raven Storm. How are you doing, Raven?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing great. I absolutely love your name, by the way, Raven Storm. Is there a story behind
thank
that?
You. No, you know, it just was something that I came up with, actually.
Well, I absolutely love it. I think it's a great name.
Thank you.
So if you could just give myself and our listeners a little backstory into how you became a writer and just maybe what led you there.
the writing of my book, Loving the Addict, really started out as jotting down in a journal for cathartic purposes. I was severely beaten and left for dead by an ex-boyfriend of mine. And part of the healing process was basically writing down my thoughts and feelings. And that is really how it came to pass, to become the book. It was something I had not planned on doing, but it is something that has been an absolute dream come true for me.
All right. Well, let us know a little bit about the book, what it's about, because it sounds to me, I've read just a little bio about the book, and it sounds absolutely just gripping, like you can't even put it down. It seems fast-paced, exciting.
That's what I've been told, yes. basically, it's about a 5.5-year relationship that I had with this man and my story of basically being with him and what took place in our relationship and how it ended. And it really talks about his drug addiction and the physical and emotional abuse, as well as it's a love story. And it has a lot of twists and turns. People have referred to it as a carnival ride when they're reading it because you just don't know what to expect.
So what inspired you to write this book? You said you just did it on a whim, but was there anything where you're like, I need to write this down? This is a great story. People need to know about this.
I really wanted to share my story with the world because I felt if it could help one person who is in a domestic violence relationship or someone who may be trying to get out of that situation by sharing my story, that I was hopeful that maybe by reading it, they would realize that there is hope out there and that you can get out of that situation and you can survive it. And I'm living proof of it.
What was the hardest part? Because I know this is probably a really personal thing for you. What was the hardest part about writing it?
Sharing the whole story. Really going into detail and explaining my relationship and letting people know what I really went through and how hard and how painful it is to go through that situation.
I can imagine just writing the book would have bring back a lot of bad memories, but I'm sure this book's going to help out thousands and thousands of people that are in similar situations that don't know how to get out of it.
Yes. It did bring back some memories, and it was painful at times. There were certain chapters, of course, that made me feel a bit uneasy, but for the most part, I really didn't have a problem writing it because it was a true story. It was my story, and it really was a sense of freedom for me. It was like the final closure to the whole chapter of this situation for me. It's been an amazing journey, very therapeutic for me, and when I started writing the book, I went from victim to survivor, and that is a message that I want to give to women out there. You don't have to be a victim forever, and you can be a survivor.
Did you learn anything else other than that about yourself writing the book?
I learned that I really just want to help women out there. I became a domestic violence advocate, and I started a website, which is loving-the-addict.com, where I have an open forum and an open blog where people can write to me, and I, you know, answer all of my emails personally. And I feel that I have a great connection with a lot of my readers. The reviews have been fantastic, and I really just love sharing my story. And when somebody writes me and says, your story has been so inspirational and you have helped me tremendously get through whatever my situation is, it means the world to me. Because that really was the purpose of writing this book.
Well, for a second, let's take out there, because I don't think not enough people realize how big of a problem domestic violence is, and a lot of people turn a blind eye to it. Do you want to talk to that for a little bit?
I think the hardest part right now is that we have been trying to fight so hard to get this act bill signed through the House of Representatives, which is the Violence Against Women's Act. And I think what people don't really realize is that domestic violence right now in our society today is a lot higher than people realize. It is actually more than cancer and heart disease at this moment. Most people don't want to discuss it. Most people don't want to talk about it. they feel it's a taboo subject. But it is something that one in every three women every 90 seconds gets beaten, battered, abused, or killed by a spouse or loved one.
How can our listeners find out more and help with that, help stop that? Is there a way, a website, information they can get?
Yeah, they can go to the VAWA.org. They can contact their congressman, their House of Representatives. They can also go online and look up domestic violence. There are all kinds of organizations that look for volunteers, that look for people to help others out there in this situation, and just reach out and be there for someone. The biggest thing that someone can do is just be a really good listener. Not every woman wants to have someone tell them what to do. And everybody thinks it's so easy to leave, and that is the hardest part of being in an abusive relationship, is leaving your abuser.
So this book, is this a biographical kind of book, or is it a novel? Oh, so it's biographical.
Biographical, yes.
All right. What do you want your readers to really take away? Other than the stuff we've already talked about, what can they learn from the book other than that?
Well, they'll definitely learn a lot more about me. I want them to really take away with almost like a lesson that, yes, I chose to be in that relationship, and for many people who are in that situation, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. My relationship with this man did not start out abusive. It turned into that as time went on.
Yeah,
but they're not alone.
Love.
And I think that's the hardest part, is when you're in that situation, you feel isolated, you feel alone, that you cannot reach out to anybody, and there is so much help out there just with a phone call. And I really want people to know that if they know somebody who is in an abusive situation or maybe going through that, or you may have an idea that something is going on, open up your mouth, because you never know whose life you can be saving.
Why do these people stay in these abusive relationships? Is it due to love, or is it fear, or anything? I just want to educate
our listeners. It's a combination. It definitely is love, but there is a great amount of fear. For me, it was torment. It was fear. It was torture. It was mind games. There were threats to my family, to myself. The first time that I actually ever left him, I went out to my car when I was leaving him, and I found a dead dog's head covered in blood in the back seat of my car. This was the torment that I went through. There gets to be a point, there is no leaving. They find you, they follow you, and they make your life miserable. So sometimes you have to stay in that situation. It's almost like you have to be released from that prison that you're in, and it really is a prison.
Could you share with our listeners just an interesting story, maybe from the book, just to get them interested? Because I know here, I'm just looking at the bio, and it says police chases, drug lords. This doesn't sound like a normal abuse relationship. This sounds like a movie, honestly.
Yeah, it has everything from love, lust, obsession, dominance, betrayal, thievery, police chases, arrests. It has a hostage situation, physical, emotional abuse, and then as well as a love story.
Well,
so there's every aspect of the book. It is an absolute roller coaster ride, and it's very gripping, and I really hope that people take the chance to read the book and like the book enough that they can understand my story and possibly share it with others.
Is this a one-and-done book? Is this your only book? Or now do you have the writing bug and you're going to start writing more? Or?
I have thought about writing another book, but right now I'm kind of just focused on this one for at the moment.
Definitely. So how can our listeners get this book? Where can they buy it? Online, your website? Just give us the...
They can buy it on my website, which again is www.loving-the-addict.com. They can also get it on barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com, most of the online bookstores at the moment. We're trying to get it right now into the stores. I will be embarking on a book tour come April, so hopefully we'll be in more of the major bookstores. It takes a little bit of time.
Can they get it on their Kindles?
That's where they can get the book.
Okay.
And it's available also in PDF as well as an e-book.
All right. Well, that is great to hear. Well, Raven, thank you so much for coming on Audio Dust Jacket and sharing this your story and your book with us.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
It was a pleasure. And if you write anything in the future or want to come back on, we'd love to have you.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Well, you have a wonderful day, and thank you so much.
Thank you. You
all right.
Too.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket is Dean Tong with his book, Elusive Innocence. How are you doing, Dean? So let's go a little bit into your history before we go talk about your book, Elusive Innocence.
All right, so it all got started for me almost 30 years ago in 1984. My then first wife sued me for divorce, and shortly thereafter it became a protracted custody battle, and shortly thereafter I was accused of molesting my 3-year-old daughter. Actually got accused again. First time it was dropped, got accused again the same year, 1985. And on the second allegation I was arrested, facing 25 years to life in prison if I had been convicted. Obviously no medical evidence, just allegedly my little girl's word, who at the time was purportedly coached by my ex or mother. And, of course, the state of Florida dropped criminal charges, but I wound up having supervised visitation for arguably the longest stint in Florida history, 5 years. I had to see both my daughter and my son, who even wasn't part of the abuse allegations, supervised, chaperone, monitor for 5 years. It wasn't until 1989 that I could get unsupervised visitation. And I never did get overnights until they reached adulthood. So I took matters into my own hand. I started doing media. 1989 was my first radio show, WDBO Orlando. I started becoming an activist for fathers' rights, writing books. My first book published in 1992, over 20 years ago, Don't Blame Me, Daddy. I ran for state house representative in Jacksonville in 1994. Took this all the way to the Florida legislature. Governor Lawton Childs, our former governor, met with him, spoke to legislative committees, held rallies, gave seminars, educated attorneys who didn't have a clue on how to try these cases, and wrote a couple of more books, including the one that's the feature of this interview, Elusive Innocence, which published in 2002, over a decade ago, and then went on to get my master's degree in 2006. And now I've been hired in court cases from all states in America, all 50 states. I've worked cases where folks may have their parental rights terminated or are facing jail time, can retain my services, and it won't cost them a dime. The judge will consider ordering the state to pay my fees, and that's happened in a half a dozen states. So you have a right to an attorney. You have a right to experts. In these bitter cases where your parental rights and freedom are hanging in the balance. So I have become an expert in what's known as child victim hearsay. He said, she said, what a young child says. And that's usually how this goes down. Only in about 5% of cases do we see actual rape findings, medical findings. Usually it's just the word of the kid, and that's enough to send you to prison. It's enough to separate you from your family. It's enough to take your kid away from you.
This sounds like a big problem that no one really knows about, because I would never think this would be a really big problem. It sounds like a horribly big problem throughout all 50 states.
Yes, it is. And this is known as the child outcry or disclosure of sexual abuse is known as the exception of the hearsay rule. In other words, it's coming in, whether you like it or not, and your lawyer can object to the cows come home. The allegation is coming in. It's up to an expert like myself to glean whether that allegation was made contemporaneously, spontaneously, whether it was the product of external influence like a DVD, an internet website, a book, a movie, mother's coaching, another kid at school who might have put the thought idea or a story in the kid's head who is accusing an adult who could be natural daddy, could be a boyfriend of the mother, could be a grandparent. The point is, that's all that's necessary to wind you up in handcuffs. It's all that's necessary to take your kid away from you, and the government to come in, Child Protective Services to come in and take that kid away.
Why do these things happen?
What do you mean?
What are the situations like? Is the spouse trying to get something out of it? Are the kids upset? How do these situations arise?
Most of these cases are what we call in psychology unfounded source misattribution errors. In other words, perhaps the abuse happened, but you got the wrong guy, mistaken identity. And I'm an avid fan of testing the accused. In other words, doing polygraphs and psychological, psychosexual risk assessment, battery of tests. But most of the time, there's another alternative explanation, another hypothesis for why the kid is saying what he or she is saying. The problem is the state is only going to allocate so many resources to basically determine what's going on here. So if the kid points to you as the molester and they believe they've got their guy, they're not going to go down another road. They're not going to look at some other Tom, Dick, or Harry that may have molested the kid. They're not going to look at another possible reason for why the kid is saying what he or she is saying. That's up to you, the defense attorney, and the defense private investigator to do so.
So let's go into your book, Elusive Innocence. And what was the purpose of writing this book?
Well, that was my third, and this one really was geared for attorneys. With all due respect, lawyers don't get this stuff in law school. This is on-the-job training. They'll be glad to charge you $25,000 and take your retainer check. And then you may be calling me 6 or 8 months down the road because you're in the same spot you were 6 or 8 months ago when you hired counsel, and your case has gotten nowhere. You've done nothing proactive. You've done nothing on the offense. You're playing the let's wait and see what happens game. Can't do that in a case like this. You got to actually be the intimidator and not let the state be so. So I wrote this book to guide attorneys, mainly, of course, parents who are accused, by the book all the time. It starts off with actual case studies, one that I actually consulted on from Texas way back when, and then about 20 years ago. And then it goes into the agencies that get involved here, the Child Protective Services Agency, which does the intake investigation, the agency that does the interview with the kid at the Child Advocacy Center, the police, and interview methodologies. Sometimes they use best practice, sometimes they don't. Most of the times they don't. They'll use situations where they'll use anatomical dolls and puppets and drawings, trying to lead a kid into fantasy land. They'll use suggestive and leading questions and reinforced behavior and all kinds of things to induce the kid to implicate you, the accused, because they don't want to conduct a witch hunt here. They don't like to go out on fishing expeditions. They want something for their time and their resources, so they want to make sure this is a confirmed case. And let's not forget the fact that every time you become a statistic, and let's say you're convicted or the child protective judge says you did this, adjudicates a child dependent, they get money. CPS gets money for every confirmed founded case. So there's a cha-ching associated with this behemoth agency, Child Protective Services.
So they just want to find a bunch, close them, make
then
the
I
money.
Go into strategies, how to help your attorney, to help yourself to clear your name, whether it's taking depositions, using the family court case as a crutch to help you in the criminal case. And then there's all kinds of appendices at the back of the book. There are internet website listings and listings for attorneys and organizations to help you, and case law, state-by-state case law. So the book pretty much is the A to Z, all nuts and bolts. If you were to get involved in a situation like this, the book could actually guide you. Of course, you'd have to hire me to be part of that equation, part of your defense team. But the book is pretty much a tool to assist the parent and attorney through this maze.
Are there any preventative measures people that deal with children on a daily basis can take to sort of avoid some of the pitfalls that of being accused of things like this?
Not really, short of having a videotape hookup. There's a website, x10.com, x10.com, where you can hook your business or your daycare center or your bank, hook it up like a bank where you have audio video surveillance of the kid.
I feel like that could get you in even more trouble.
So if the kid says something that is rather, you know, you know, it's confusing to the provider. You know, you have it on tape. You have the kid unilaterally taped. So that's your best accountability is taping. And other than that, obviously, let's say your kid goes to school. Kid has a little bump or bruise, and the kid's wearing shorts. Teacher's a mandated reporter. If the teacher teacher only has to report a reasonable suspicion of child abuse, if the teacher thinks that that was deliberately caused by a parent after questioning the kid, teacher has no choice but to call it in. Otherwise, the teacher can have his or her professional license revoked and be arrested for failure to report. It's a very slippery slope, and usually it's a slope that errs on the side of the child.
That is really, really scary. Did you what tips would you give, or do you have an interesting story for our listeners that would enlighten them on this situation? Like a situation, a story about something that happened that people would be unaware that they could be accused of sexual molestation of a child.
Well, you know, I've commented for a long time now in high-profile cases. I appeared at the Michael Jackson trial in 2005. Folks just have to Google my name. I'm an op-ed writer at newswithviews.com. So if you go to newswithviews.com or groundreport.com, I'm an op-ed writer at both of those websites. I've written articles on the Michael Jackson case, the Kobe Bryant case when he was accused of date rape back in 2004. I recently wrote an article against Jerry Sandusky, the Penn State coach who was convicted of raping all those boys years ago. You know, I don't just represent men and fathers. I get involved in cases where mothers have lost their kids also in custody battles because the judge thinks the mother is a falsely accusing parental alienator. Ironically, my first book, Don't Blame Me Daddy, that hit the bookstores 20 years ago in 92, was the first book in America about sexual abuse allegations within custody battles. And unfortunately, it started causing judges to believe that a custody battle and an allegation of child sex abuse surfaced. Well, Dean Tong said that that's a false allegation. So, you know, I'm sorry, you're trying to wield the child as a pawn, weapon, or tool, ma'am. You're trying to coach this kid, so I'm giving custody to the father. I never said that. I have seen legitimate, genuine child sexual abuse within custody battles. So, you know, this is much more complex than that. And you have to, you know, it takes a lot of work to get these cases right, a lot of work, a lot of burning the midnight oil hours. This is all about right, wrong, truth, and justice.
Well, it's good to hear that someone like you has taken upon themselves to go into the other side of it, because most of the time, you're right, if someone accuses someone as a sexual predator, the person accused is normally already written off and has to defend themselves. It's not innocent until proven guilty. It's guilty until proven innocent in this aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. In these cases, especially if you're a man or a father and you're accused of physical abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence, all a woman needs is a statement of fear or threatened bodily harm, no proof, no evidence. If you don't believe me, try it for yourself and see if you get arrested, because you will. So, you know, we are in a no-touch rules America world, and that includes women and children. And unfortunately, you know, hearsay is admissible, and it's enough to get you in hot water in a New York minute.
Well, that's scary. Dean, how can our listeners get a hold of you, and how can they buy your books?
Yeah, my website is abuse-excuse.com. And all my contact information is listed at the bottom of the pages there at the website. There's a lot of free information at the website, too. There are tips that you can, a tip page you can click on for preventive medicine purposes to try to put yourself in a situation where you won't get accused, or if you are, how to take action if you are immediately. The book is available at that same website. There's an author products page there, as well as other books I've written, as well as tapes that I have and white papers, and also Amazon.com. The book Elusive Innocence is over at Amazon.com as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for enlightening us on this subject that I had no idea about.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. That brings us to the close of another great show. I'm your host, Kevin Finn, and for everyone here at the Business Radio X family, we will see you next time on Audio Dust Jacket.